Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to The Fundamental Principle. I'm your host, Jerome. With me today is my dear and good friend, Mr. Christopher Sandbatch. Chris, how are you doing this evening?
Pretty good. Pretty good. Just like fourth, like be nice to Yankee Day. Yankees Day is over. And so like, I'm like back. I get really energetically screwed with at the beginning of July because like, and it didn't happen to me until July 2nd this year, but like I'll wake up usually and like, or first week in July, something strange will happen to me. And I will suddenly focus in sharply on the fact that like it is some anniversary of the Battle of Gettysburg, and then I'll get like my synesthesia will be triggered.
I posted the opening from Into the Dust about, you know, every 14-year-old boy
You know, that's a good book. I mean, it's actually not a good book. Intruder in the Dust is not one of Faulkner's best books, but that paragraph is one of his best paragraphs.
No, well, it's very highly evocative, and I got to say thank you because you're our number one referrer on Substack. But the thing that I love about that particular paragraph, not the book isn't my favorite, but the paragraph, that paragraph is like pure. That's like some of the finest prose writing that's ever been written.
And it cracks me up that I'm y'all's top recommender on Substack. People do not people do not expect this from me because I wrote 6 horny poems about a guy, about a woman that I was sitting next to at a cafe yesterday, but I was too scared to talk to. So I just sat there and wrote French poems about her over and over and over again. People don't expect the religiosity from me, but like, yeah. And I was like, yeah, of course. Like, of course, I can't be very performatively religious though, because I don't know how to be. But like, I'm like, yeah, everything I do is like, and this is very Faulknerian as well. Tie this into the Faulknerian like sort of bit. Everything I do is so actually like saturated in like. Really, my Jesuitness is what it is. So you get to take that however you will.
Your Jesuitness I love you and you drive me nuts. And the Jesuitness is the heart of that right there. That the particular for the listener, Mr. Sandbatch and I have been friends for gosh, probably 10 years now, but. The precision with which you speak is good. That's like the Dominican, like, I like that, right? The proper distinctions and all of that, like, but it's the casuistry that occasionally will drive me up the wall. Where
there's that and the negations. It's the sort of like ontological negations that I'll do. So like frequently what I'll, and this is like how, if you're familiar with the way, and really because I mean, I'm from an Anglican family, and like we're actually going to, we're going to talk about this here in a minute. You know, I'm from an Anglican Protestant family. I've been Protestant since 1564, actually. Like, can show you the paperwork in England where like we were some of the first ones to sign up for the Church of England, and that never really changed. Though I did have some Catholic ancestry. I had some, like, I am a descendant of the second colonial governor of Maryland, whose plantation was at Green's Rest. And that was, of course, the Catholic colony. And so there were two sides of my family. One were recusant Catholics, and the other were like diehard Anglicans. And so like I do, like, just even just in that, there's this oppositional warring that like occurs inside me. And then the Jesuits supercharged that, because the Jesuits, and they were the ones that educated me. It's the religious order that educated me. And the way I can only really describe the way Jesuits go about educating someone is they, like, first of all, they teach you that you're better than everyone else, okay, and that you don't even have to tell other people that you're better. In fact, I was, you know, like, there's a guy that I hang out with that went to the high school.
He went that's low class. Why would you have to do that? You
just right. I was at a 4th of July party yesterday with a guy that I knew from high school, and he follows me on Twitter. And if you follow me on Twitter, I've been like being like a woman on Twitter the last like week or so. And he was like, "You got to cut that shit out, man. We don't do that." And I'm like, "Yeah, goddamn, you're right. Excuse me. I'm going to apologize." I'm like, "Yeah, you can." But so the way the Jesuits will educate you. First of all, they'll tell you that you're better than everyone else. And then the second thing they do is they start to build an edifice of ideas. So like you'll have this, like you have this this solid foundation in what we would call like classics, first of all, but like not classics like you learn them in college or anything like that. It's like you start with St. Augustine and you like sort of like build. And if you know anything about St. Augustine, you know that St. Augustine's ability to sort of negate himself is very intrinsic to the Augustinian sort of like mode of being. So like he'll, you know, like he'll have this line about, you know, to Carthage then I came where a cauldron of unholy love sang all about mine ears. And like, think, what is that? How can there be an unholy love? Okay, there's a negation. There's a collapsing negation contained in there. And so what the Jesuits will do is they'll build this incredibly elaborate architecture of ideas, and then they will like step into the center of it, and they'll show you where the pin on the grenade is. It's like, where is the logical fallacy in this architecture that will cause it to all implode like the World Trade Center? And then they'll pull it out right in front of you. And it can be maddening if you're not used to it. Like if it's not like inside, if it's not like natural for you, you're like, what did we sit here and do all of this for then? It's like, oh.
Yeah. Well, the thing that they do better than anybody, and this is why they were so great in the Counter-Reformation, is, and even the, I think the manual like says men astutely trained, right? Like, so their formation process is like 13 or 14 years. It's ridiculous. Like every Jesuit pretty much has a PhD by the time they're done.
Yeah.
Right. Like they're really, really well educated.
They're like literally warriors is what they are. So this right. is like Societas Jesu. This is not a peaceful order.
No.
They came into existence for the explicit purpose of being the warriors against the, like they're the military, they're militarized Catholicism against the Reformation.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah. And what made them so fantastic about that is that, I don't know how else to describe it, except as like, if dear listener, if you've ever boxed or fenced, and I believe, well, I know for a fact that Ignatius fenced because he was a Catholic nobleman, a Spaniard, right? And if you've ever done any of that, right, there's the feeling each other out phase and probing for weaknesses phase, and then there's the, you know, the punch or the strike or the thrust, like, oh, I got you, I moved you offline, and then bang, right?
Yeah.
And that's what the Jesuits do better than anybody, like that pulling the grenade, right? Like they'll sit there and engage with you until they have you figured out, and then pow. And then
here's my favorite example. Okay. And this is like, so one of our mutual friends used to do this all the time, and I'll do this sometimes. I do it really performatively in front of people where I'll do the St. Paul thing, you know, bitch about St. Paul. Okay. And so one of the ways the Reformation was very effective, one of the ways the Protestant Reformation was very effective was that it took literally, it took the Bible, which had been in Latin, and we really, by the year 700, it was strange. Nobody could really understand Latin really by the, British Latin couldn't be understood. We know for a fact that British Latin couldn't be understood by people in Italy by the 7th century. So like the collapse was actually relatively quickly. So a lot, you know, and it's a little mythological to say that these texts weren't available for the medieval world, because of course there's the Saxon gospel and the Highland gospel and all this. But by and large, people didn't read the Bible very much because it was in Latin. It was hard to get to. But the Protestants made quite a bit of hay about, you know, being able to read this thing. And it's like, well, like, you know, and there's the famous bit with St. Paul where, you know, St. Paul in the book of Romans, he appears to take this line that is almost contradictory to Jesus. And this is the, you know, sort of the render under Caesar bit, you know, where, okay, so Jesus in, you know, Jesus is doing this render under Caesar bit, but, you know, we're told also in the text that, you know, he's that the Pharisees are trying to trick him. And so he says they're trying to trick him into saying something that they can arrest him for. And he's really careful about it. And he says, you know, this is what I'll tell you. He holds up this coin, says, render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's. And what he's really saying is, if you use Caesar's money, then he is your God. You know, and you know, there's a reading of this where he's like building sort of counter economics. But St. Paul comes back through in the book of Romans and he says, you know, you need to pay your taxes to the temporal authorities. Okay. So Protestant theologians were making quite a bit of hay about this apparent contradiction, but the Jesuits are able, because of this incredible, oppositional mentality, they have this incredible bulldog oppositional theologizing, militarized theology, is they're able to, and I think their reading is correct, because they're able to go, and what they do is they historicize it, and they say, well, St. Paul is writing to you know, a group of incredibly persecuted Christians who were getting really antsy. They were getting really sort of violent and militarized at a time when being a Christian at the city of Rome was not politically correct. You know, this is a great way to find yourself in the Colosseum fighting lions. And they're starting to make a bunch of hay about, you know, this bit about paying taxes. And, you know, really what St. Paul's doing in his letters, he's writing, he's like, look where you are, man. He's like, this is not a point that you can afford to go out on a limb with right now. Like, you know, we just got this thing going. You're the mother church. They're going to fucking clamp down. They're going to clamp down on you. You know, you just got to pay your taxes. This is the way we're going to do this, you know? And like, that's a Jesuit reading. And that's the way Jesuits were they stopped the bleeding of the Reformation is really what they did. So like the Reformation was threatening to sort of like engulf all of Christendom. And then this kind of very medieval, they get in trouble for being modernists all the time, but the Jesuits deeply internalized sort of like the tripartite aspect of nobility, which is, you know, in ancient Christendom, there is, you know, nobility is conceived as that there are knights. They're knights temporal is what they're called. So it's temporal. It's of this world, you know. So that's the nobility of this world. And then there's the nobility of spirit, which are the, you know, sort of the priestly class. This is what the clergy is. And so the Jesuits really internalized their role as sort of the knights of spirit. And then there's the third, you know, third domain that is the ether, and that's the ethereal role, the nobility of scholarship, and that was the Jesuits did both of those really. They blended those two into like one sort of force for counteracting the Reformation.
Yeah, well, I the Jesuits were very Roman, and I'm going to mispronounce this because my Latin is terrible, but it's the Frumentarii, right? Were the Roman secret police.
No, that was right. You got it right. You even got the emphasis right. Frumentarii, yeah.
Anyway, right? Like, these guys were probably the most effective type organization. You know, for the limits of the technology they had, they were as effective as the Stasi, man. These guys were serious dudes. And, mm-hmm. you know, they would, like, set bait traps, like, during the really bad persecutions, right? They'd do things like, have double agents, you know, I go fishing today, and they'd find you, and then they'd show up at your mass, and then all of a sudden, like, all the exits are sealed, and there's Praetorian guards with, like, you know, scorpion shields, and Gladius is just like, no, we're just going to slaughter everybody inside this church.
Yeah. They were savage. They did a lot. They operated, you know, they had a lot of conversos. It's true. They had a lot of conversos, but you have to remember they're operating like Spain is where they operate out of originally mostly. And so like they're doing this thing where they're in this incredibly multicultural area.
Right.
Andalusian influences, there are Jews on the loose, there are all kinds of destabilizing forces.
And the Basques, and in fact, Ignatius himself was a Basque, I think. So when St. Paul is writing, right, like we're talking like, you know, serious problems internally. And then, of course, right, you know, oh, the Spanish Inquisition, right, blah, blah, blah. Well, actually, it was a really important, right? Like the Jews had opened Toledo, the gates at Toledo. They'd fought the longest war in the history of the world so far, from having just a little tiny bit of Celtic Galatia in Galatia, in the northwest coast of Spain near Oviedo, right, and retaking the entire country from roughly 700 to 1492, right, and
yeah. It's one of the most incredible martial feats in world history, actually, that this happened.
Right, yeah. It's absolutely a miracle. And we got the Moaz Iberic right up out of it, which has obvious Arabic influence. But in Islamic Spain, right, you have Jews, Berbers, which is the people St. Augustine comes from, Arabs, Turks, Visigothic Germanic Spaniards, Basques, who still to this day no one really knows what the fuck Basques are. Are they like Neanderthal populations? Like, what are these people? And they stayed mostly faithful, right? But you've got the Balearic Islands. You've got this absolute mishmash. Like, why was Spain this? Like, why were the multiple medieval kingdoms of Spain? Like all these separate kingdoms. Well, because the place was a complete mess for like 1,000 years before.
But you also had this issue though, where, I mean, the papacy is not in one of its, not really, I mean, it's in what sort of temporally seems like one of its flowering eras, but I mean, the Medicis were a Spanish family. Okay. And like the Medicis additionally are using Spain as a base of wealth to do their, to essentially fight their wars of fortune on the Italian peninsula. So it's also sort of being treated as like a piggy bank for various other, European causes.
Right. Well, I can't remember. When did the silver mines run out in Spain?
I was going to say that too. It's like this. Well, and I don't know when they ran out in Spain, actually, but it's going to have to be sometime prior to God. It's probably somewhere in the middle ages. What most people call the middle ages, but I call them the high middle ages sometimes. But I mean, this actually even happens. This idea of using Spain as like the piggy bank for Catholic Revanchism, this is actually, people will talk about what collapsed the Spanish Empire, and they'll talk about, they're almost never right. What actually happened is that, Philip II was like literally, he was using the silver mines in Potosi to fund the religious wars of all of Europe. And so like, it's just like, yeah, all this wealth was coming out of these silver mines in Potosi, but it was also immediately being spent on other shit, So it's like, that's what happened with Spain. Yeah. Spain has always been, but I mean, the reason Spain was so good for this though, is because the Spanish are the most warlike people in continental Europe.
Absolutely. And
they're lazy, because warriors are lazy people when they're not fighting. Okay. And these people have been at war by the time the Protestant religious wars start, these are people that's been at war. They've been at war continuously for 700 years.
Right.
They're good at it,
Well, the Spanish Tercios were the most deadly unit in Europe for 250 years.
Yeah.
There's actually a great movie with Viggo Mortensen where he plays Captain it's a famous Spanish. It's like the equivalent of a...
I've seen clips from it. I've never seen it, but I've seen clips from it.
Watch this. Let me find it. Anyway, they're asked, and they're just decimated by the wars of religion, particularly in the Low Countries. And the change in technology that led that was combined arms, and the Tercios used to be these pike regiments, right? That were completely just iron discipline, just absolutely insane, right? But he's asked to surrender. It says, you know, and Viggo Mortensen speaks fluent Spanish, so he, Captain Alamora, I think is the name. Anyway,
let me yes.
Anyway, let me look it up, Captain. Anyway, like he says, with respect, sir, this is a Spanish regiment, and Captain Aldo Triste, and it's from 2006. Absolutely, just take a look at this. This is like right after Lord of the Rings, and Viggo Mortensen is the height of his powers. It's a fantastic, fantastic film. But it's like a Spanish. It's like a Spanish Three Musketeers. Like it's just fabulous. Anyway,
right.
Is
this the one about the horse where he's like got a horse?
No. That's
it's a different one. He plays it. Yeah, he plays. I am like the only person in the world that likes Viggo Mortensen's roles outside of Lord of the Rings more than I like, because that's like this the shit I like. I like you know, like Spanish, like white Mexican nobility fighting bandits in like the 18th and 19th century. I love it. I love everything about it.
Yeah.
Hacendado drama.
Yeah. Anyway, it's a fantastic film, but he does a very good job of showing like what life was like in the Tercio. And until I want to say Gustavus Adolphus like revolutionizes warfare in the 1620s, basically with combined arms, and the 30 Years' War, like the Tercio had been undefeated on the continent for like 150 years.
Finish.
But so what had happened, and there are documented cases I remember reading about, is like, you know, the French justifiably, right, in, you know, like 1100, be like, we're going on crusade, and why won't you join us? Like, aren't you like a kind of the, you know, equivalent of like busting people's balls, I guess, of like, why are you not going on crusade? And the Spanish should be like, sir, I am from Spain.
Yeah.
We are always on crusade. And,
right.
And legitimately, you know, for 700 years, like there was always a crusade. And Spain itself is, I've talked about this other shows, right? Like, you know, France has six gigantic river valleys that make it like rich and prosperous and like easy to get through. There aren't really that many mountain passes to go through. Spain has like one big river.
Yeah.
And you've got these,
and it doesn't go through the middle. It doesn't go through the middle of the country either. You know, it's like along the top rim. Like it's not a climatologically friendly place. Like people go to Spain, it's hot. It is hot and dry in Spain, you know?
Yeah. Right. Not only is it hot and dry, but it's just a, it's a difficult, like the mountains make it very difficult. In fact, you can make a pretty good case that, that like the fact that, Madrid is where it's at is like what indirectly led to the bankrupting of Spain, because you just had, you know, like the Thames or the Seine in Paris, right? Like it was really easy to get stuff to and from any major city in, say, medieval Germany, medieval Spain, or not medieval Spain, but in medieval England, right? The Highlands of Scotland are poor because they have crappy transportation. And like Spain is a country of entirely of like highlands. It makes absolutely badass fighters.
Yeah. It makes it very
difficult to like get rich.
to interrupt you really, this is so on point with like some of the stuff I've been doing. Actually, I don't know if you're familiar with the outlet, The Decadent Serpent.
No,
they're kind of new. It's like a literary cultural thing. It's published out of, I think, Glasgow. And I've been translating Spanish because nobody ever translates Spanish poetry. I've been translating Spanish poetry into English, and I have one coming out with them tomorrow. But there's a whole Spanish poetic form called the Serranía, which actually means Song of the Mountain Woman, is what it actually translates it to. And it this beautiful rolling lilt. It's like Partiendo de Conejares a la Suso en la Montanina, you know, like Cerca de la Travesana Camino Travosares, you know, and then like the way that sort of translates is, and this is a very very Iberian sort of mode. And it's this whole Spanish poetic form that really came out of the tail end of the Reconquista. But they always start with this like location. It's like always, there's always a warrior. He's always a single solitary warrior knight. And he's like traveling in the mountains and he encounters a woman. Okay. And it's, they all start. So that one that I just read, the way it would start translated literally is like across the whole high country from Tramos to Veratone. I never met so fine a girl, leaving Conejares, climbing windward on the mountain back, glancing down the breaker's pass, dry towards the Travosares. You know, it's like, and it's, you can hear that sort of very classic Spanish rolling lilt in it. But these songs are all about a warrior traveling alone through the mountains, because that is the experience of Spain. You know, like they're like, you know, these are the, what did they call them? I can't remember. Not conquistadores, but there's a name for the people from Galicia and Spain. They were like these like warrior, like not quite aristocrats, but kind of like, you know, something in between. Can't think of it right now. Oh, well.
Yeah. And this is with the Jesuits, right? The Jesuits came from these people. You know, St. Ignatius Loyola was a Basque nobleman who like was almost killed in a battle. Right, like this is not a, and then right the same time that 1492 they kick all the Jews out, they start the Spanish Golden Age with Columbus.
It's funny how that works out. You kick the Jews out and start the Golden Age. Oh wow,
you know, the final reunification of Spain with Granada falling. Right. And then just Spain just explodes. Right. Because they within, you know, it's not like, oh, Columbus finds Hispaniola and then they spend the next. No, like they've crossed Mexico. They found Peru. They found the silver mines in Peru. Like this is all happens in like 25 years. I want to say
it's like two generations. Like it's like it happens so quickly that like when you read conquistador narratives and that sort of thing, like you think it's like, God, this had to happen over like 100 years. And then you realize that Bernardo Diaz, he's an eyewitness to these. He's there with Cortez. But these minor figures like Inigo and Francesco de Ayllón, these minor figures that appear in this Cortez narrative, they also go on to have their own conquistador narrative. So like de Ayllón was the guy that he attempted to be the conquistador that took over South Carolina, but they all got yellow fever and died. But like this is explosive. It happens so fast. They just like it, like setting the Spanish conquistadors loose in the Gulf Coast South was like dropping a nuclear bomb on like an uncontacted tribe. Like those people did not stand a chance.
Like war mastiffs, like
yeah, yes,
the finest steel in the world for the the gladius, right? Like the Spanish sword. Like, so these people had been building the world's best swords for like more than a thousand years.
I mean, just look at the numbers. Like the 121 Spaniards defeat an army of 6,500 Incas. What? That should not even be possible. Like that's just like, you should just be able to Zerg rush them and like, and end it. Like, you know, it's like there, that shouldn't have happened, but it did.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and, um, I think the word you were thinking of is Hidalgo, right? Like the
Hidalgo, that's it. And that's also the name of the movie. That's also the name of the Viggo Mortensen movie with the horse. Yeah, that's it.
Right. But like these guys, right? And they were very intensely, I think that our age is too cynical. Like, no, these guys were like completely 100% unironic. Like Magellan goes around the world, does this thing that takes absolute, like, I don't know how the ship held his gigantic brass ones. Right. And he had almost no ego whatsoever. He literally just credited everything. He's like, La Virgen. Like that's his, you know, and Columbus, you know, his entire thing was like, no, we must spread the space. We must, like convert the Indians. Right. He thought he was converting, you know, the pagan, you know, Hindus, but he, like, they legitimately did. If they got rich in the, you know, like, okay, God rewards us for our good works, but like they legitimately did just want to spread the gospel everywhere.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's one of the things, if you ever read the Bernardo Diaz narrative, this is one, because I've done all, because this is like my back, this is literally my background. It's like a history of the Atlantic Basin, and this is the early end of it. So it's like, you know, empires of the Atlantic world. I've read a lot about the difference between how the Spanish arrived in the New World versus how the English arrived in the New World. You know, the English at Jamestown were still had some of this medieval, like, sort of naivete to them, but not in like, it was already collapsing to the point where they couldn't really communicate very well with the Indians. Like, Cortez is this character who is so unironic that he gets along with Montezuma pretty well. And the reason you can only, and when you read the Bernardo Diaz narrative, one of the reasons you see is because they actually understood the world in remarkably similar terms. It's like, oh, okay, my God just defeated your God, so you serve my God now. That's how this works. And they were like, and like, you know, a lot of these like conquered Aztec states were like, yeah, that makes sense to us. And they're like, so how do we do this? And they were like, actually, you got to read, you know, here's 10 rules you got to follow right here. You got to quit doing that human sacrifice. We don't do human sacrifice anymore. We had one guy that sacrificed himself for all of us. You don't have to do that shit anymore. In fact, stop immediately or we're going to kill you.
Right.
You know?
Right. Well, and I don't, just like I don't think of our people today, like the average modern person understands just how, like how genuinely religious these people were. I don't think the average person understands just how bloody and awful, like, genuine paganism is.
Yeah. It's always just like some cum worship or some like human sacrifice. There's always just really nasty stuff going on.
Right. Like just how, and like to be, I can't believe I'm going to do this. Like, to be perfectly fair to the pagans, right? Like, the entirety point of Christianity, or the point of Catholicism, is like we required a human sacrifice. We just reenacted every Sunday at Mass.
Yeah.
And now, when you like with like one of the most awful deaths you've ever seen, but like we don't understand the world, the mental world that these people lived in, the way that some other people would have. And like they built, I am personally convinced that like the only way that the American megalithic structures were able to be built was like with like supernatural assistance of the demonic variety. Like straight up, like I don't think that like, wait a minute, like you're building gigantic temples with no draft animals and yeah, like in the middle of a swamp. Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of stuff. I was actually talking to a guy, he's out in Durango right now, and he was like, and he was telling me that the natives there, their story of how they came into existence was white aliens came from outer space and built shit for them. I'm like, oh man, there's a lot going on there. There's a lot of parts there.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I think it's important that people understand, like, you know, like there's a wonderful, it's not even that big, by a gentleman by the name of Warren Carroll. He's the founder of Christendom College in Front Royal, Virginia. But he wrote a wonderful book about just what happened in like the pagan New World. And it's called Our Lady and the Conquest of Darkness, and it's absolutely of like you want to understand. If you want to understand, just like you can watch Apocalyptico, which is a great movie. I think it's Mel Gibson's best movie, actually. Or one of his best, maybe. The Passion's a masterpiece too, but like that's what it was like. And I think all too often Christians want to make it about like a debating society thing amongst ourselves, and like that's not what really happened, bro. Sam, are you there?
Oh yeah, I'm here.
Okay. Anyway, go ahead. It was bloody. It was terrible. The proof texting each other sort of stuff wasn't really in play until. You can see it kind of in the Council of Trent and other elsewhere in the 16th century, but like the performative dunking that you see on Twitter or elsewhere just didn't happen.
No, you know what, you know how they would have, how that would have been treated. There actually was in almost all of the Romance languages, or in almost all European languages, especially from that era, there is a phrase or there's a word or like something that they use to talk about, to refer to somebody it's like too into theology, that was like considered to be like a little bit antisocial. It's like, that's what monks do, you know. It's like, we don't, but like, and like, so like people will like tend to think it's like, oh, it means they're less Christian or something. Like, no, they understood everything that they did in terms of Christendom. Like it sort of, it saturates their lives totally. It doesn't have to be textual. It's not, they're not like following instructions from a theology manual or so. That comes much later.
Yeah, you know, it's all visceral.
Yes. Right? Yes. And that's sort of how for better or worse, I kind of, because New Orleans is, everybody knows that I grew up in New Orleans, and New Orleans is very, because I mean, again, the nominal reason we're just sort of talking here today is kind of like my, like, what the hell are, why the hell are you a Catholic, Sam Batch? Because I've sort of famously not been one at times, and I've famously been one at times. And, you know, I have. Do you actually know the narrow incident that caused me to sort of collapse out of Protestantism? You know, you know what happened?
I know a little bit, but please elaborate. I mean, because basically what I heard was like, I'm going back to church. And I was like, all right, good. You know, and that was the extent of my commentary. I'm like, you stop going to that orange church. Okay, good. Like,
Dark Enlightenment checks in on me occasionally to find out if I've apostatized. Again. or de-apostatized, and you know, but I had like last year I had really one of the worst years I have ever had, and like I was doing I was dating a Polish woman, and she was like the most predatory, torturous thing I've ever encountered, but she was and it was really causing me a lot of like sort of like really strange internal contradictions. And because this is one of the things that Protestantism does. If you're like sort of if you're a theological Protestant, and I have tendency, like I said, I have tendencies towards theological Protestants, particularly Calvinism, where I will let doctrine of reprobation, like, because I'm not the wealthiest person in the world, you know, and I'm like, so like, oh, the fact that I'm not wealthy means I'm not good. Okay. I will like concepts like that will seep into me, and like, I will like fall into like sort of like theological recursion, and like, you know, essentially become helpless. But, you know, I was in one of these like sort of downward spiral modes where, and the way I think I described it, well, I don't think I talked about this when I was on with Dimes the other day, is that Protestantism, you know, and your mileage may vary on it. I'm not the most like sort of vindictive evangelical person. I'm not evangelizing to the masses or anything, but there's a particular type of person that, and I actually think Protestantism, to get into this a little bit, I think Protestantism itself, most Protestant churches, even my own Episcopalian or the Episcopalian churches, theologize its way into trannydom. You know, it's like they've recursively theologized their way into like, oh, maybe Jesus was a tranny. And like, that's your brain on Protestantism. There is no stopping this thing. There's nothing to tell you, okay, you've done enough. You've done enough deconstruction. You've done enough inverting and deconstruction. You're on your own. And, you know, you have to figure this shit out for yourself. And I think the Protestant churches, largely the institutional Protestant churches, have all done this to themselves. One of the reasons I think they've done it to themselves is because there are actually not many reasons for Protestant churches to exist. If you actually look at because, you know, when you think about it, Catholic is a state. Catholic is a unitary state. It's a thing that you can do, and it's relatively stable. It's Catholic. It's universal. It's forever. Okay. Protestantism it's a verb. You're protesting something. Okay. You're actively doing something. So like the whole reason for this sort of Protestant complex to exist, this recursive theologizing, is we have to remember, what is its inflection? What is its inception point? Martin Luther has these theses, these complaints about the way the Catholic Church has been running itself for the last 100 years or so, and he wants them remedied. This was not a thing that was ever meant to become permanent. It was not a thing that was meant, it was like, we're supposed to attempt to reform these issues inside the church, the way this church behaves. But, you know, after the generation of the first reformers, who went on balance more or less got everything they wanted by the time the Council of Trent occurs. Okay, so this is, you know, this thing that kicks off the Counter-Reformation. One of the nasty bits of the, like, you know, sort of Counter-Reformation theology is that there's an admission that a lot of these original Protestant claims were true, and then they fixed them. So it's like, okay. So what is your reason for continuing to be Protestant? You have to start inventing them. And to do that, you have to start doing this sort of recursive
Semper Reformer, right? Like, yeah. Like, yes. And Mench is Moldbug pointed this out, 20 years ago now. Like, there's no logical endpoint to that, right?
Yeah.
Like, and if you're always complaining, if you're always undermining your society, like, you're gonna end up with some weird shit. And there are things about Protestant praxis that I think are fantastic.
Yeah.
Like, let me give you a couple examples. I know we've talked about this in the past. Like, Vince Gill in, like, 1987, like, his brother dies, and he writes "Go Rest High on That Mountain."
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful song. It's just gorgeous. And things like "Will the Circle Be Unbroken" and "Go Rest High on That Mountain," that those could only come from American, Scots-Irish, low church Protestantism.
Yeah.
And there's something beautiful there, and there's something good there, and there's something true there that no Catholic society could have come up with. And as much as I would prefer all of those people who are good, honest, decent Christians to, like, stop being stupid and come back. But America without those people would be would be in real trouble, right? Like, politically speaking, you know, if it was only like Boston Brahmins and Catholics, like, we would live in a socialist shithole full of communists. And like, you know, immigration was bad, now it'd be worse. So,
yeah, it would. Everything would look pretty much how it does in the places where in Boston.
So, right, like, that's something beautiful. And the English plain song tradition is beautiful. Like, there are some things that I don't know as much about the, you know, the German side. I mean, like, Bach was a Lutheran, so I guess I can't really knock that. Like, there are these virtues that I, in whatever strange way, like the grace of Christ, like, they were talking about Christ, so somehow it was still elevated. That I think the Catholic Church needs to, like, be like, okay, we'll keep that part, right? Like, the finest liturgy in English, in the world, was, you know, and I'm like, you know, the TLM only guy, but I will fully admit that, like, a properly done high church Anglican service is way better than the Novus Ordo.
Like, oh, the Merbeki Mass. This is what's interesting about the Merbeki setting of the Mass is it antedates the current what is the name of the Latin rite? Not the TLM. What is the actual name for it? It's actually different because I've been going. I go to Latin Mass sometimes, and I've been what is the name of it? Tridentine Mass, God, Lord, it's Tridentine Mass. Yeah, the English, the High Anglican Mass is actually older than, it's only older by about 10 years, but it's older than the Tridentine Mass, which is, it's kind of funny I put it, but yeah, the Novus Ordo Mass in English, and I usually go to a Novus Ordo one just because I don't, there are a lot of reasons, because there's only one Latin Mass in New Orleans, and it's at St. Patrick's, and when I go, like, I'm well known enough on Twitter that like they'll be like I'll park my first. You got to park $25. It's $25 to park your car down there. So I'm like, I don't know about that. But when I I'll get out of my car and I'll start walking. And like by the time I get there, there'll be like a small group of amanuenses behind me that have recognized me from Twitter. And they're like, are you C. Salmon? I'm like, yeah, it's me. Yeah, come on, guys, let's go.
Yeah,
but I also don't like to go to that one because they stop and they do three separate collections. They get money from you three different times, and I'm like, oh, come on, it's too many times. And then the other one is the reason, because you know what my confirmation name is, don't you?
No, I don't actually.
It's just Jude. So there is it's actually an older church than St. Patrick's. On Rampart Street in New Orleans, there is it's the Church of St. Jude. It's the International Shrine of St. Jude as well. So there is it is big in the St. Jude world. And then they also have one of these very sort of little interesting saints. And so I'm actually, it's the medal that I'm wearing right now. They have the icon of St. Expedite. Who I don't even know if, are you familiar with him?
No, I'm not. Please elaborate.
Yeah, so Saint Expedite is one of these saints that has like sort of been declared to have not actually been a real person, but he's in all of the early martyrologies, and he was a Syrian soldier. He was a Syrian Roman soldier in the 25th Legion who he has this idea that he's going to convert to Christianity. And, but then he says, he's tired or he's drunk or some shit like that. And he says, I'll do it next week or something like that. I'll do it next week. And in the night, a crow comes to him and, compels him to do it immediately. And so he does, he goes and finds a priest and converts. And then he's, promptly killed in battle. Okay, and so there's always this figure. He's depicted as a Roman soldier, and there's usually crows, and there's a crow at his foot or something like that. And Saint Jude is the patron saint of lost causes, and Saint Expedite he's the patron saint of needy arrivals, of desperate causes, and you know, merchants for some reason. But yeah, so Saint Expedite there was a statue of a saint that was shipped to the Ursuline nuns in New Orleans in the 1920s, and it was marked Expedite. And we don't even actually know if it might have just been like a shipping label that said, you know, this needs to get there fast. But the nuns read it as it's a Saint Expedite icon, and so it's been in that church ever since then. It's one of the local South Louisiana local saints.
I see. Well, right, life is lived, in a visceral manner, right? Like you can kind of break down, and you and I have both known guys in the manosphere, right, who will kind of break down like what goes wrong with women and kind of analyze it and right. But ultimately you can't like abstractify like is this woman your wife or not? Right. Like is this,
yeah.
And those moments are going to be visceral. They're not going to be like abstractified. You can abstractify about them later maybe, but like, oh, this was really miserable. This girl was not a good girlfriend, and you know, we've talked a little bit about that privately. I don't want to get into it on the show, but like, yeah, you
somebody's going to hear. Somebody who knows her is going to hear this.
Probably. I mean, I just assume that at any Latin mass, like any young guy under, not that this show is super popular, but I assume that any young guy who's under 40 or under, especially under 30 at the Latin mass, like they're at most two removes from a podcast I've done in the past.
Oh man, that's a lot to say two removes. Like the Latin mass in Austin is absolutely. I mean, it's like if you're in Austin, Texas, and you want to meet some aligned guys, go to the Latin mass. You're not gonna meet many women, but you meet some dudes.
I've only done the whole like running into fans in the wild like one or two times, and I was not. Not happy with it. It happens
to me so often. It happened to me, like, of course, I mean, I've got a much bigger profile now than I used to. It used to only happen in churches, but like, I was in a bar in the Bywater a week or so ago, and like, somebody recognized me, and I was like, y'all should not have been able to follow me here.
Well, but this is why, right? Like, the story, you know, and you and I have worked together for many years at this point, right? The comprehensive failure of the narrative given to us by the establishment media and the government is why we're here. And then the that same comprehensive, like, I don't know, our mutual friend Pete calls it the Nuremberg regime, right? Like the religious settlement of the 20th century, like, is obviously wrong.
Yeah.
And the whole Semper Reforma thing of like, okay, if we have to like constantly complain about this post 1946 settlement, like, then you end up with like drag shows in churches, and you're like, whoa, 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 like, how did you end up with like the Bible requires me to do stuff that is explicitly condemned in the Bible? And
I will see driving that discourse more often than I do anywhere else, because I've started noticing it more. I find it's that damn connection with the Israelis, where they'll be like, you know, like, as a rabbi's son, because Protestants love the Old Testament for some reason. I mean, they do. I mean, I love the Old Testament as well, but Protestants love the Old Testament. But they also will tend, because again, there's no sort of canonical, like, sort of like scaffolding or anything like that. They will frequently just assume that, like, well, these Jews, they got these rabbis, and that's their holy book. So let's go ask the Jews what they think about this Christian doctrine. And it's like, well, if you do that, you're going to get what you ask for.
Yeah, that's a big mistake. Don't do that.
Oh, my God. They were doing, I saw the one I saw the other day was this very big, like, large Twitter account. And he was doing this thing where he's like, you know, he's talking about how like it's incumbent on Christians to aid the nation of Israel. And he says, it says it in the Old Testament right here. As a son of a rabbi, it says it right here in the Old Testament, book of Ezekiel, so on and so forth. And I'm like, yeah, I bet if I go into that, I'm not going to find anything like that. And like I did, I went into the Hebrew, and you can use ChatGPT to translate Hebrew. It's great, actually. And I went into the book of Ezekiel, and I'm like, what is the exact verbiage that's used here? And it doesn't say Israel at all. It'll say like sons of the house of Judah, the people chosen of God, and that sort of thing. I was like, that is not the nation of Israel that was established in 1947. That is a totally different. That is a totally different word. That word does not appear. That is not what they're talking about. Totally different thing. That dude blocked me. He blocked the hell out of me.
Well. Good. But this is the problem, right? Is if you're going to constantly, and you know, I'm not, you know, Curtis Yarvin mentions Bullbug, right? Like, I started reading him 20 years ago, after the, you know, the failure of the Ron Paul revolution, and asking myself what went wrong. He says a lot that's really valuable. And the best thing that he did is gave me like a really old book reading list. Right, of those forgotten 18th and 19th century guys that like were making these kind of points, and just in the post 1946 Nuremberg regime settlement, like we just kind of elided over the fact that, like, I don't know, Thomas Carlyle, the greatest British literary figure of the 19th century, was like, this is retarded and dumb. Don't do this. And we're just going to, you know, after 1946, we're like, we're just going to ignore, I don't know, everybody that we were supposed to listen to. Right. And I forget who it was who talked about this Calvinist mindset that kind of became the, you know who I'm talking about, the East Anglia faced woman, like that,
the schoolmarm.
Yeah, that always looks like she just smelled a fart, like Liz Warren or the Kate Brown, the governor of Oregon. Like, and there was a I want to say a Yankee scholar who talked about the Puritan mind. And I can't remember the name of the book.
Perry Miller, The Mind of New England.
Right, but like, and that basically, you know, Moldbug was stealing from that. And he was very explicit. Like, I stole this idea from here, you know, to give Curtis his credit. He did, like, I am stealing from this person. And this is what I think after reading this. You know, he was very good about, like, citing his sources and talking about who he stole from. But anyway, like, the whole idea that you can build a life on constantly complaining and that you have to intellectualize everything to come up with a justification for something leads you into this downward spiral of just not being able to live a life. Right? Because life is visceral, and sometimes you just do things because that's what you do.
Well, you know, that's essentially what was happening to me. I found myself not necessarily, I mean, I have, because I hesitate to call it the Protestant sickness. It can manifest itself in a lot of ways. Obsession with Israel, obsession with like sort of like textual theology will do it in one thing. But also, like, if you have this Augustinian bent that I have, it will also, like, you can become relentlessly obsessed with sort of like recursive self-hatred. You can do that all, like, you know, I mean, almost would almost have to look it up. This is a big, like, you can even see this in Augustine. He'll do this, like, I love not yet. I loved it, you know, out of wanting to be loved, I could not be loved. So on, you can actually, your mental framework will descend there, and you'll like find yourself, you'll get to this point where you've frightened yourself from leaving your own house. You've, 20% of your brain power, 20% of your caloric intake is now, like, it started off as this like tiny little trickle, but like, you know, 3 months later and a couple of bad turns in your life, you have like built this whole elaborate complex self, you know, really narcissistic apophenia is almost what you might be able to call it, which is like narcissistic self-mythologizing, where, you know, your own wretchedness becomes the cause of your own wretchedness, and it just spins in circles, and it paralyzes. You can become like sort of mentally paralyzed. And I had been at that, I had been there for like quite some time. And again, it's like I said, I was confirmed this is like one of these things where people like come to me, they're like, you've been a Catholic for like 3 weeks. I'm like, really? I've been a Catholic almost my whole life. But I am temperamentally Catholic, and I have been like sort of institutionally Protestant, because I was like, again, I was converted sort of somewhat violently through my Catholic education. And then I relapsed into Protestantism for quite some time. But, you know, I had been in this place where like, I mean, it's like almost like when Augustine himself talks about it, he refers to it, he calls it a fever. It's like, it's this, like this, like heat, muggy, swampy morass of the self, which is like, and that's like really what it felt like. It's almost like, you know, almost like hellish. You imagine hell is hot and like sulfurous. And like my mind, my brain had just been totally overloaded by this like sort of like ontological questioning why these things were happening to me. Like, why did this woman turn out to be so predatory? Why does this happen to me? Why did I get in a car wreck? What am I doing wrong? You know, like, and there's a Protestant theological reading where, you know, your own reprobation is the cause of all of these things. And that's, you know, sort of where I was and everything. But I was on Twitter doing a thing. And I, because, you know, Edward Habsburg is on Twitter, you know. And
yeah. Legitimately, probably one of the sanest political figures in Europe today. Like this.
I wonder if he still follows me. Let me see. Habsburg. Yes, he does. Yeah, very cool. Yeah, so
the legitimate king of the world, like
right. That was like, this is what I said, and I he had said he had tweeted something, and I quote tweeted him. I said, and I was like, it was some wager. If something turns out to be true or something like that, I'll go straight to a priest and reconvert to Catholicism. And then, like, within 2 hours, whatever the – I can't remember what the wager was. Within 2 hours, it turned – he was right. And then he's in my comment section being like, now you have to do it. And I'm like, well, all right. I just got, like, converted by the sword, you know, converted at sword point by the House of Habsburg. That's – I don't think anybody's going to say that's not valid. So that's – that was how it actually happened. So,
the one true king of all Europe just told you to go – right? Yeah.
That was my response. It's like, oh, the emperor, the literal emperor of Europe just converted you to Catholicism. And I'm like, yeah, God, now. And now I'm also like, also sworn defender of the House of Habsburg anywhere and at all times, you know, like I should get a uniform and wear it is what you should do, you know?
Yeah.
So that's how it happened. And then like a lot of things, I have also... I had this strange shit going on this year where like I had never seen a David Lynch movie before. And then I watch, I go on with Capitalismo and Micah Pohl and we watch Blue Velvet. And that night, unbeknownst to us, while we're talking about this, while we're watching this movie, David Lynch is dying. So David Lynch dies, you know, it's like, oh shit, you like Sandbach killed David Lynch. I was also doing something very similar with the Pope, who like you didn't like the last Pope very much.
No, again, no, I did not.
Again, because I was, and I would make a kick. I never had a problem with him, but the because of course he was a Jesuit, and the case to make for Francis's papacy, I think actually is that you know again in strict Jesuit terms, he took a church that was not in retreat or anything, but it was sort of stagnant, and he did cause by hook or crook, or even by opposition to him, he did cause a reflowering of Catholicism. And from absolutely. but see, from a Jesuit perspective, that still counts,
right?
You know,
absolutely. It is between, and I will give him credit. He was the greatest recruiter for traditionalism ever.
It works. All the podcasts that you made talking about how much you can't stand him and converted all these people to Catholicism, you were working for him. You were working for him.
maybe on the other side, he'll be like, I got you. I'm like, okay, well, if that's what happened, I doubt it. But, you know, like miracles do happen. And the thing that needs to be understood, I think, for people is... Not that there weren't like of the 95 theses, there were probably 30 that had like legit like, oh yeah, that is a problem, you know.
Yeah, some of them were just drunk German guy ranting.
And to a large extent, right? Like this had always been a problem. Like the Universal Catholic Empire of Charles V is a nice dream, but in practical terms, right, how can you be the king of the Spaniards and be the king of the Netherlands, right? How can you, as a Netherland, as a Dutchman, be like, that's my king? Like, because, and I'm going to ask you to, like, pay a bunch of money and go die for my personal interests in, like, the Italian peninsula, and you have to because I'm your king. Like, but you're not even fucking Dutch. Like, how can you sit here and tell me that I got a banker? Like, you know, like, I can... You can kind of like legitimately understand why people in, say, Saxony were like, you want me to go all the way to Bavaria and like fight people?
Yeah.
Because like I'm a Saxon, like I'm a Prussian. What are we doing here? You know, like, you know, so I can legitimately kind of understand why the politics side and truthfully, right, this notion of the apolitical papacy is what killed the Middle Ages. Like, no, the Pope was a political player. It's And legitimately so, right? Like, you had to have the Papal States just so that that shouldn't couldn't be like some king with a sword right at the Pope's neck being like, no, this is what you're going to do.
And, yeah.
Right. Like, so there are real historical difficulties that led to the Reformation. And I would have, you know, in my alternative history that I, you know, occasionally think about, right? Like, if they'd done a more confederated model of like, okay, we get it. It's a little ridiculous to have one guy be the king of Austria, Germany, Hungary, Czechoslovakia.
Yeah, none of that happened on purpose. This is like one of the things I have to explain. I did a little bit of this with Dimes the other night. But like, you know, like the papacy in particular, okay, so like really one of the things that people need to understand about Christianity generally is that the Protestant Reformation does not grow out of, it's not like the schism with the East where it, like, it's like this, you know, very, this like, which to me really almost reads like this strange inner Mediterranean quarrel where like, you know, there's this thing about the filioque, but really underneath that, there are lots of very personal issues with like, oh, okay, the scheming mother of the Byzantine Empire has all of the Latin merchants in the harbor killed at once, and like there needs to be some kind of reprisal. Like, that's really the answer. Like, people talk about the filioque and everything like that. Really, the thing that caused the Western schism. I mean, the mutual excommunication between the Pope and Patriarch had already happened, but that's like nobody really paid attention to that because then, like, there's a new Pope or a new Patriarch and they haven't mutually excommunicated one another. So like it kind of goes back to normal a little bit. The thing that really did it was an incident called the Slaughter of the Latin Merchants.
Yes.
In the harbor of Byzantium. And it was like at this point. So the Byzantine emperor is this like little retarded boy and his like evil, poisonous mother is like pulling the strings, and she has all of the Latin merchants in the port of Byzantium killed at once. And they're like, no, we're not doing this shit anymore. That's it. No, that's what Julius Caesar would call Greek degeneracy. And like, we're not doing that shit anymore. Okay.
Right. Well, and the Venetians at this time, right. the Venetian Republic lasted 1,000 years. These were serious people. The arsenal at Venice was the first industrial, like, you know, like mass production, like these were serious people. And you did the one thing that you don't do to the United States or to republics generally. You fuck with their boats. And
yes.
Right. Whether it's Pearl Harbor or the USS Maine, we both know that there was problems with both those. But you gave them the pretext of like, you mess with our trade and you don't do that.
Yeah. And that's the important stuff.
Yeah. And that, like, again, these are political. And you know, as much as I lament the schism in the church, you know, like the idea that you can just banish politics from human affairs, it's not possible. And I think that there's a very, very,
you know, the idea that you can is non-Catholic.
Right.
That is actually one of the shared, the Eastern wizards, not so much the Greek ones, but the Russian, because the gravitational center of the Orthodox Church is definitely in the Slavic world now.
It's Moscow.
And, I mean, yeah, and the Slavs have, and trust me, I know the Slavs way better than I did a year ago. They have two Slavic women have taught me about a whole new world. But I had been to Russia. And it was did not really know the Slavs. I had to have two disastrous dating kerfluffles with Slavic women in the United States before I truly started to understand the Slavs, the Slavic mind. And they all, one of the strange things they share with Protestants is this concept of like this division of the temporal and spiritual. You don't see any of that. You don't really see that in the like in Catholicism. I was talking to John Dee about this. It was the night the Pope died or whatever. And I was like, you know, like you have to understand. It's like you can, and I would tell you this too, some, to one extent or another, is that political Catholicism is a thing, okay? And like political Catholicism cannot really, and this is the Jesuit in me talk. There's like, I think sometimes we could do a little liberation theology as a treat. the idea of divorcing the political from the religious is fundamentally anti-Catholic, because again, this is all one thing. It's just all lived, you know. You can't really divide them. Now, well, you know, what the course of political Catholicism takes. You can't stand outside the thing and bitch about it. You have to be inside it to be able to bitch about it. And that's there's another argument for American, right, well, for American Catholicism in particular.
Well, and I've talked about this in the past, but like you and I have talked for years about just how weird the 19th century was. And I thought of it, I put it out there recently, like when Nathan Rothschild took over the Bank of England in 1815 after Waterloo, right? He took over the world because he had a pigeon in the right spot. Think about that, right? He had a pigeon in the right spot, and so he was able to take over the world. But the fastest way to get a message was like, okay, if you have the equivalent of like a text message from like 2007, where it's like in code and maybe one or two lines, is the most you can send. You can send it via pigeon. If you have anything more detailed or longer, like a page, it has to go via a skinny guy on a fast horse with multiple remounts. And there's no, I mean, 80% of the world is agricultural peasants, the same way 80% of the world have been agricultural peasants since, you know, the time of Marcus Aurelius. And there was no telecommunication. There was no rapid transportation. There was, they had the cradle scythe, I think, but, you know, there was no mechanical agriculture. And by like 100 years later, in 1915, you have mass electronic communication, you have massive steamships, you have trains, you have automobiles, you have airplanes, you have food preservation, you have refrigeration, you have almost completely mechanized agriculture. Like everything in the world changed from 1815 to 1915. It's just, it's not even the same world. And how do you respond to that in a Catholic sort of way is not only the focus of like Rerum Novarum and Quadragesimo Anno and all of these other great encyclicals of the 19th century, but also pretty much what the Second World War was about.
Yeah.
I mean, if you really think about it, like, okay, like, of the responses to modernity, right? The, you know, the dark and satanic mills, they grind people up. And legitimately, like, they'll just, like, you know, chop a three-year-old, like, chop an eight-year-old's arm off and be like, oh, that's unfortunate. Grab me another eight-year-old, right? And, like, okay, maybe Marx has a point in 1848 where he's like, you just chopped up you just chopped up a second grader. Like, that kid should be learning, you know, that kid should be learning how to read and preparing for his first communion, and he chopped his arm off and he's going to die. And, You want me to not, like, burn down the entire, like, you know, like, Marx, obviously an evil man, probably under the influence of demons, like, a bad man. But, and Stalin, of course, like, one of the worst human beings in the history.
But there were other people, too. There were Chartists, and then there was my guy's John Ruskin. Of course, I joke all the time, this is, of course, I'm determinedly English, so now that I'm Catholic, I can really let my pre-Raphaelite freak flag fly. You know, Marx was not the only guy that was saying this sort of thing. And outside of Marx, the people that you find that are opposing it they're almost universally Catholic.
Right.
It's like,
right. Well, but like something has to be done where like something is as unjust as like an 8-year-old gets fed into the, you know, dark satanic mill and like loses limbs and like is maimed for life if he's lucky, or just gets killed.
Right. Like, I mean, those are just specific acute incidents. Everyone could see. This is what I was talking to John D about this last night. Oh, it was 2 nights ago. I was talking to John D about this. And we were talking about the Industrial Revolution. And really, we were talking about like the advent of electric lighting and about how actually people didn't like electric lighting when it came around, because like if for no other reason than it like illuminated their houses so well that you could see the dust. And they were like, shit, we've been living in filth. Let's turn the lights off. We don't have to notice it anymore. We were doing just fine. And now you have like anxious housewives on amphetamines, like scrubbing everything down and painting everything white. You know, it looks like all consequences, all downstream of the Industrial Revolution. People did not like the Industrial Revolution when it happened. There's this sort of myth now that it was like some incredible great leap forward. The average person on the ground resisted it. And even, you know, the Industrial Revolution, whatever else it was, especially the first one, America kind of gets a weird pass on this because we had the frontier. And when we were talking about this, I was pointing out, it was like, you know, like the, if you, in a real integrated reading of history, Manifest Destiny and the Wild West, which are like these incredible, iconic American sort of modes of life and this sort of thing, you know, what causes these things is people fleeing the, you know, labor enclosure, property enclosure, and, you know, and sort of the wage labor, like lifestyle of the Industrial Revolution. In England, they weren't able to do that. There's nowhere to go. You know, you could go to Australia, but took a long time to get to Australia. But sort of what happens is that over the course, of course, they're 8-year-olds being tossed in like this grinding machinery. And there's like 8-year-olds dying of cancer because they're like, you know, they're chimney sweeps. And if you physical contact with anthracite coal causes tumors to develop, and it happens relatively quickly. So like these kids that are like climbing up these chimneys to like clean them out, they're quickly developing these tumors, growths all over their body and dying. Like this is manifests is externally, obviously physiognomically bad. But, you know, at a deeper level, what was happening is on an evolutionary level, the Industrial Revolution was selecting for dysgenics. Okay. So, and you know, Orwell talks about this. He says, you know, people will always attribute World War One definitely was the cork in the bottle, but these were processes that had been begun 150 years earlier, even before anybody knew really what evolution was and what like sort of, selective breeding would do. But the Industrial Revolution caused a massive demasculinizing event because it incentivized this very different kind of man who was like, Orwell said, more like a cockroach than a person. Like, yeah. You know, it's like, well, like we want this thin little guy. Yeah, go ahead, excuse me.
In 1915, the British were amazed at how big the Canadians, the Australians, and the Americans were.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Six inches taller.
And 40 pounds heavier. Yeah. Like we're talking, and, you know, roughly speaking, from, I want to say, I mean, like the Han Chinese were doing stuff, like important stuff for a very long time. But roughly speaking, from like 1500 on, world history is, like again, at 1492, right? Like Charles Murray talks about it in Human Accomplishment. But basically, from like 1400 onwards, world history is a contest between like large bearded men who, on the North Atlantic. Like, period. Yeah. Right, like guys who were
five, the Spaniards, yeah,
like yeah, the North Atlantic, right? But world history is this contest between guys who are somewhere between 5'10" and 6 foot, low 6 foot, like 6'1", 6'2", bearded, strapping, strong guys from the North Atlantic. Like that's it. Yeah. That's world history. And
they're not lifting weights. They're not doing deadlifts either. They're just eating a shitload of red meat, like having a lot of sex with women and like they're outside all day, you know.
Like they're eating a lot of pork, stabbing people and riding horses. Like that's what they do, right? Like this working out is gauche and ridiculous. But fencing practice where you're doing like 1,000 lunges. Well, that's just what you do in the morning, right?
You know, one of the things I always wished is that I guess it was like 5 or 10 years ago when the old alt-right, we were really rolling before like the 2017 stuff happened. We were like really doing a good job. And that was what I did in college. I did fencing in college and I was on the college fencing team. And it was a club team. It's not like I was on scholarship or anything like that. But we had really started to like weaponize and get into the historical European martial arts. I always thought that shit was really cool. And I wish that had worked out and not become like, you know, wish they hadn't like done like Pride Day and all that awful shit.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, that's okay. Like, I'm getting multiple messages here. I probably need to rise up here.
No, that's part of that is me. Yeah, that's like, well, no, yeah, no, you can't. It's pipe. It's coming through my headphones. Yeah.
No. Well, I mean, you and I, whatever we get, we'll just be like a you and me, just a stoned out jazz rhythm section. We'll just go for like 5 hours.
Yeah.
you'll riff a little bit, and then I'll riff a little bit. That's just how it goes. This has been awesome. I think it's important to just touch on that last point you made, and then we'll have to do it again sometime soon.
Yeah.
Life is visceral, and it is that separating like historical HEMA, right? Like there are two types of people who do HEMA. Historical European martial arts. There are National Socialists or adjacent people. And yeah. Total shit libs. And it's just, and you see that same sign of bifurcation in all kinds of things, like modern paganism, like the type of guys that will want a real visceral religious experience but reject Christianity. They're almost all raised low church, so they don't understand the intellectual problems with, but anyway, like those guys, modern pagans, are almost all like guys who will wear the, you know, lightning bolts, SS runes, or like the worst sort of absolute worst sort of shit libs you'll ever see in the
face. Yes.
Like there's this bimodal distribution all over the place of people who understand that life is visceral. They just understand how to get there.
Yes.
And actually real traditional Christianity, particularly Catholicism, is visceral. It'll get you there.
Yeah.
It all, like the food you eat, the exercises you do, you know, the way you live your life, it'll all be visceral. And a lot of the reason why, you know, someone like yourself, someone like me, can go to any Latin mass in America and be like, young man under 30, what's your favorite niche right-wing podcast? And I'll be like, oh, would you like to, you know, this sadly happened, right? Like I had dinner with a guy and he was like, oh, I love Z-Man. And I was like, this is like literally the weekend before he died. I was like, oh yeah. Hey, I talked to Z last week.
Yeah. Right. I was hanging out with him in Tennessee, you know,
like, no, I corresponded with him like not even 2 weeks before he died. And I was like, oh yeah. You know, I'll write him a note that I ran into one of his fans. And, because we've told people life is like this intellectual thing where, and I'm not rejecting the intellect, obviously, right? Like,
yeah.
Anyone who's any familiar with anything I've done, I'm probably up my own ass way too much. But life is about the visceral stuff, and only Catholicism at the present moment allows you to be fully Western and live viscerally.
Yeah, I mean, and that's actually really probably the most success. I've sort of interrupted the whole last 2 hours occasionally with bits and pieces of the story, but that's actually the best summation of it. I mean, the Polish girl, she said something to me very near before we broke up. She said, "I can't be responsible for getting you back into your own body." And that was the thing that actually really stuck with me and probably tipped me over the edge. Because, I mean, she's not actually evil. She's got some problems and she's all fucked up. But she's also brilliant. And she was right about that. I was like totally out of my own body, like sort of just head shit too much. And Catholicism actually is it's a way out of that. It's actually a way out of that. If you like you want to do you can just do things. It's way easier to just do things if you permit yourself, if you are, you know, I don't even like to say it this way, but you are permitted mistakes. You know, there's acts of contrition. It's not, you know, your eternal soul is not, you're not going to have to answer for everything as long as you, you know, Yeah. And it's like one of these things where it actually is, it's a living thing. You can live your life as a Catholic with in a, I think Catholicism's biggest weapon right now is that we live in an age that is so full of headship. It's so full of words and like words and nothingness and internet vapor and like stuff that doesn't, you can't put your finger on it and feel the heartbeat. You can with Roman Catholicism. And ultimately, as like when I say it saved my life, I was like probably going to stroke out. And then I was talking to the priest. And I was like, yeah, I need to offload some of this guilt. And he was like, well, that's what I'm for. And I was like, yeah, that's right. and that was what did it for me. Yeah.
Good. Well, and that's, I think that that's why the TLM is a thing. That's why ultra political stuff for young guys is a thing, is like the enlightenment of getting in your own head is ultimately a mistake. And I think that's what people need to understand. People kind of are groping towards that, right?
I think that's right.
Yeah, they're groping towards that. And it's not to say that there weren't some virtue in some of it. I'm too honest with myself to say that like everything, like, John Locke not wanting to have women or atheists testify in court was probably the right move, you know?
Right. Yeah.
but ultimately it's self-defeating. And I think that only through that kind of go out and live your life. And then you'll find that the truth that the church promotes is there in your life everywhere you go.
Yeah.
And Mr. Sambash, where can people find you if they're interested in your writing or following you?
For now, I'm on Twitter. I don't know how long it's going to last. I left all my group chats. I left all the group chats I was in a couple of days ago, and I've been like teetering on getting out of like Twitter just because, I was like kind of on Twitter, but kind of been on Twitter this whole time. I've been on Twitter, been kind of trying to find a wife. I'm like, maybe I just need to find a woman in New Orleans. So, but I am on Twitter right now. And then, of course, you can find me at on Substack. I'm at Ecologica Americana. And then I've got some other stuff that's in the works that I'm not really ready to talk about. But I think I'm going to be publishing a couple of books this year, finally. People have been after me to publish books for a long time.
Yeah, I have.
And then maybe... like the last thing America needs is another book publisher, but not like this. I'm different. So I have a concept that I might be unveiling here soon. So yeah, that's what I'm doing for now.
Well, that sounds excellent. I strongly encourage our listeners to check all those out. Mr. Sambach is not only an old and dear friend of mine, but also I think one of the finest writers I've ever met. So, please,
you know, like just for the readers, because it's been, I mean, just for the listeners, it's been 2025, it's been almost 10 years now that you and I have been occasionally doing shows together. It was actually Dark Enlightenment that actually tipped me over the edge into, like, because I had appeared on a podcast as an as a tester to see how I do on something like that. And then you were up the next episode, and it's still like, it is, I'm not going to tell people which episode it is of which podcast, but it was one of the most convincing hours of like audio content I have ever listened to. And I was like, yeah, I could do this. And then like, kind of like, we're like doing stuff together. And then like, now that's all ancient history. It's been so long, but yeah. You're Dark Enlightenment is one of my biggest inspirations, actually.
You're very, very flattering. Thank you, sir. But no, like seriously, folks, check out his writing, check out his other appearances. Not only one of the most brilliant guys I've ever had the pleasure to work with and be friends with, but also, and in an era where all too much is kind of not glossed over, Sambach is one of the most genuine guys I've ever met. So please check him out and buy his books when he finally gets around to publishing them.
Yeah.